Enjoy food the way Mother Nature intended. Alaska Seafood, wild, natural, and sustainable. For more information, visit www.wildalaskaseafood.com.
Hey, thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. This is Katie, HRN Executive Director, and I'm so excited to share with you our coverage from the Charleston Wine and Food Festival.
We are here live today at Charleston Wine and Food.
Join us as we talk all things food.
Come to Charleston, eat some seafood. Eat all of the seafood.
Chicken fried chicken with chorizo steak and salsa verde mashed potatoes.
So quintessentially like Southern fare at its finest.
And have important conversations.
We're also talking about professional women in restaurants and how underrepresented they are, people of color in restaurants, and how they're not talked about.
We get real with Food Network's Manit Chauhan.
Balance is BS. I was told that I wasn't going to be bleeped out.
And find out about raising sugarcane with Chef Sean Brock.
It's like being Indiana Jones or something. You never know what you're going to find.
You'll come away inspired by the power of food and the food scene in Charleston. Here's Dr. Jessica B. Harris.
Food is constantly in flux. Food is always moving. Food is the only real lingua franca that we have that allows us to connect with other folks.
So tune in to Heritage Radio Network on tour at heritageradionetwork.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
You can't go wrong.
You're listening to a special episode of In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org. I am your host, Joe Campanelli, and I am so excited to be back after a long hiatus. This is a special episode because I'm still easing in to the great weekly routine that was In the Drink, but I heard that a great winemaker was in town. I'm starting to feel a little bit more comfortable with the schedule at Fausto. If you guys haven't been, please come and visit me there. And I wanted to rush back into the station here at Roberta's in Bushwick and get this winemaker on as my guest. In the studio today, we have Dan Petroski, who is the co-owner and winemaker at Massacan and the winemaker at Larkmead in both in California, and I'm so excited to have him here. You can find the Massacan Anio wine over at Fausto. It was on our opening list. It's on the list right now. Embarrassingly, it wasn't there when he came to visit a few weeks ago, but you can come and drink it. I absolutely love that wine, and those are the wines that I got introduced to Dan through. Even though Larkmead, I think, is the really historic, great Napa Valley producer focusing on Cabernet. But I'm so excited to have Dan in the studio today. Welcome to In the Drink.
Thanks, Joe. I'm excited to be here.
Does that happen to you where obviously Larkmead at this point is, you know, more famous and historic? Do people in maybe in New York know you better through Massacan?
I do think so. When I started Massacan in 2009, I was still working my way up the ladder at Larkmead. So I was went from a cellar master per se to assistant winemaker to associate to taking over winemaking responsibilities in 2012. So I was out, you know, coming home. I'm a New York, Brooklyn native. I was coming home and introducing my wines to my friends, basically, a lot of the sommelier community and a lot of the restaurants I love to eat and drink at when I was living here in New York City for a little over 30 years. So I do think that there, you know, it preceded my reputation a little bit at Larkmead. But Larkmead is my core, it's my bones. It's something I've been doing for 12 years now, something I've been really excited about, something I'm excited about the future of winemaking in California, especially the future of Cabernet in California. I do think, and you know, it's a funny story, when we've been expanding the winery at Larkmead twice in 10 years, and I told the owner, Cam Baker, he's like, how you doing? You know, we had construction right in the middle of the 2012 harvest, and he's like, how you doing? I said, well, I'm doing great, but I'm already thinking about the next winery we need to build because we're not going to make the best wines here at Larkmead until about 2020. And he looked at me like I had three heads and ran away. And I love him for that because he's given me all the opportunity in the world to do what I've been doing today.
Yeah, I mean, and that's something that you hear a lot from great winemakers, that wine is something that just requires a lot of time. And winemakers think on a different time schedule than most people do. So what do you see as, what have been the changes at Larkmead through the time that you've been there, and where do you want to take that in the future?
Sure. The best part of being a Cabernet winemaker, and I can say this in all honesty, is when you're in a given calendar year like 2018, we are releasing the 2015 wines, we are about to bottle the 2016 wines, we are elevaging the 2017 wines, and then we're going to harvest the 2018 wines. So you see four vintages at once. That is incredible. And so take that over a 10-year period. Now I'm getting to see 40 movements of wine over a 10-year period or more at Larkmead, and that really informs everything I do. Mm-hmm. And the one thing I've been really focusing on is restraint is an often overused word, but I'm really trying to figure out what the future is of this vineyard by understanding the vineyard. Like, it wasn't until 2006, 2007, when we hired a viticulturist to come in and named Kelly Marr, who has great respect in the valley, to kind of understand the site. And we're learning more and more and more about the vineyard and what its potential is. So we have a lot of young vines that we have to grow up with, but we know how they're acting and reacting to the climatic changes. And my goal is always to just take the volume down. Larkmead did big for many years. We did it really well. I mean, we're in a very hot site in northern Napa Valley, and gives us the opportunity to make really powerful wines. But I want to kind of take it down and find the nuances and complexities due to the diversity of the soil. So, it's removing a little bit of the extra oak that we had in the past. It's removing a little bit of the extra alcohol, which created a little bit of extra baby fat, and getting down to a transparency. And that's really, for me, I think that's what the future is. And we see it across the board in the Napa Valley and Sonoma County. I think a lot of the producers I grew up with in the mid-aughts, who were riding the wave of high-impact wines and big flavor, are really starting to think a little differently about, what truly inspires them as winemakers.
And I know one of the things that you're doing while you're here in New York is having a discussion tomorrow about the future of Cabernet. I would love to know what inspired this discussion, what are some of your own personal thoughts? And is it possible for us to? I know I won't be able to attend. Is it possible for? Will it be broadcast in any way or recorded? Can we view this?
That's a really great question. We'll start with the latter, with the recording of it. We've been doing this at Larkmead for a little over a year now. We've had about four sessions of the future of Cabernet. What we found out in the beginning is when we recorded and transcribed what people were saying, during the recording process, I felt that people were holding back. Mm-hmm. They weren't willing to kind of really, truly state what they thought or what they felt.
So we're not recording this, by the way. Just
today?
Yeah, today. This is just you and me.
No, it's
just the pizza. Let loose.
The pizza's great, and the pre-noon cocktail is amazing. but so we're not recording it tomorrow, unfortunately, because I find it that people are much more open to speak freely when they're amongst their peers and they have the opportunity. But this is an event I've started because I'm not an optimistic person. I'm a New Yorker, so I'm not full of unicorns and rainbows. I'm a realist in a sense, and we have challenges ahead of us, and it's not only Cabernet. I mean, it's agriculture. Mm-hmm. So if you take it to that level, you can see already my pessimism about climate change. About in the last 5 years, we've had an earthquake, the largest earthquake in that area in recorded history in Napa Valley. We had drought conditions. We then went into one of the greatest fires or largest fires in 2017, which is just eclipsed by a fire in the south. I mean, the climatic changes that are happening right now scares me. And we're actually going to have the next session in August is going to be about climate change and how Cabernet fits into all of this. Because I do think Cabernet, being the king of all grapes, has been the most adaptable, but it's been the most adaptable by force, and the force of the market demands, and the force of luxury, and the force of pricing models. And honestly, New York City, my hometown, doesn't embrace Napa Valley Cabernet the way I would love it to embrace as me being a winemaker. But we have some problems. We have style problems. We have price problems. We have, you know, we look at the, how the restaurant scene is changing. There weren't restaurants like Fausto in Brooklyn where you can go and get a great meal and a great glass of wine for a reasonable price when I was growing up. It was a lot different style of restaurant and food scene. And now as we've been expanding, the New York City has been expanding, it's more of the casual. And our prices are not casual. Our prices are, you know, and I'm being honest about this, our prices are catering to a select audience, a select demographic that comes and uses wine country and Napa Valley as travel and tourism. And then there's nothing wrong with that. We want escapism in life, and Cabernet is part of that.
So you have the economic reality and the economic future, which for a while seemed like people were doing pretty well. Who knows? It seems pretty uncertain right now, especially with some of these tariffs coming from China. And I know that was a pretty big export market for Napa Valley. The climatic changes, both with global warming and fires. The stylistic change that people are drinking differently than in the past. And I think that is maybe the most interesting thing for me personally, is this, the style of wines that people, that wine enthusiasts, I imagine a lot of people who listen to this show like to drink, isn't the very ripe, very oaky wine that was emblematic of Napa Valley Cabernet in the past, but maybe something that is more scaled back on those things. And do you see it? Do you see that that's how things are going? I know that at Larkmead, you've been in a process of picking a little bit earlier, scaling back the char on the oak, scaling back the percentage of new oak. Has that been driven by your own personal taste, by market demand, a combination of both?
It's definitely my own personal taste, and I'm not unique in that. I think we all, as in relationships in life, with whether it be with a partner or with consumption of beverage or hobbies, we tend to evolve. We tend to get a little look for more sophistication. The more we read, the more we appreciate. The more we appreciate and educated, the more we're going to spend on pursuing those habits. Mm-hmm. And as you do that, and especially in the wine world, as you know, Joe, it's a never ending, and it's a constant progression towards finding that wine that moves you. And a lot of wines in this world move me, and Larkmead moves me, but I want to move it to a point where I have that fall off the chair 1970 Aubryon moment where I'm like, wow, I'll never make a wine like that. But then after the night is over and I wake up the next morning, I say, well, how do I achieve that? And what do I need to do? What was in that wine that attracted me to it? And those are the kind of the influences. Yeah, externalities that influence me and inspire me to try to make a better wine, a wine that moves me to literally falling off the chair. And I do think that the community is, as you said, we're all, I've been doing this for 12 years. I mean, we're all evolving. If I liked the same car, if I drove the same car for 12 years, you would think I'd be weird. So why is, why wouldn't I want to change and evolve the wines? And what I always say is, you got to do the changes slowly. Mm-hmm. You got to take people along for the ride. And I'm not done yet. So
I think a lot of people idolize the wines of Napa Valley in the 1970s, like the late 60s, the 70s, maybe even into the early 80s. And we had a really interesting conversation when you came into Fausto. And I think that maybe some sommeliers look back at that time and say people should make wine more like it was made during that time. But it seems to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, that you think that there's a future of less ripeness, but it doesn't, like, there are certain things that we idolize about that time that maybe necessarily aren't the best winemaking practices.
Oh, that is 100% accurate. I've been very fortunate in the last 10 years to be exposed to an incredible amount of old Napa. Old Napa that really never resurrected itself until Scott Brenner and Kelly White resurrected the wine list at Press in downtown St. Helena, and they brought old Napa to the current day winemakers, and we were all flabbergasted. And I think the sommelier community, as we got excited about it, and then it spread, and the idea of it spread, there is this nostalgia. I mean, we all have romanticism and nostalgia for the past, and a lot of those wines, you know, as you start to research them, as you start to read about them, you start to look. You don't even have to go as far as the Andrei Chelyachev labels on the back of the Inglenook Pinot Noirs from the 40s and 50s, mm-hmm. where he lists every movement of the wine, every addition of sulfur, mm-hmm. The racking regime. You know, you can ask yourself, how much were those wines priced in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and how were they being transported across the country? Right now, if I take a pallet of wine, I move it from California to New York, it goes in a refrigerated truck. In the 50s, there wasn't refrigerated vehicles moving pallets of wine across the country, so you needed to be shelf-stable. You also have to remember who these wines were being made by. They were being made by immigrants who were looking for table-friendly wines and at the price points of table-friendly wines, and they needed to be stable. They needed to be opened and consumed over the course of a week, potentially. So there's a lot of things that we romanticize about this. I'm not trying to say that the wines were manipulated or done in a way that's not... It's not what we think it is, but at the same time, yeah, there were some great wines being made, and you know they were still just getting their feet under them and trying to make wines for what they wanted to drink. You can't fault the modern winemaking style because that was, you know, just an evolution. I mean, there was new vines being planted in the 90s due to the phylloxera epidemic in the 80s. New vines with better understanding of viticulture, better understanding of vineyard sites, better understanding of rootstock and how it informs the vine's potential in the soils that they're planted, and grape varieties, and especially Cabernet Sauvignon.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So you're saying that they added a lot of sulfur. Is that the law?
There was stability. There was a lot of sulfur. There was racking for cleanliness. There was
a lot of filtration.
A lot of filtration throughout the process. Filtering from post-primary to, you know, post-primary, post-secondary. Mm-hmm. Filtering between rackings. There's a lot of activity.
So why are these wines so long-lived? Why do they still give us so much pleasure today, if they seem kind of like super manipulated?
I wouldn't say they were moved in a way that you can say that is intervention, mm-hmm. or manipulation. But the reality of it is that they're built for shelf stability. I mean, Velveeta cheese is probably going to be pretty stable in 2040,
right?
Because it's built for stability, and that's they were understanding that, you know, it didn't take a week to get across country in a refrigerated truck. It took a month on a train,
mm-hmm.
And then how that happens, and it could be in the middle of the summer, and it could be in the south, and so if it gets to the other side and it's spoiled, that's a problem.
Right, and I have a feeling that you're somewhat of a history buff as well.
Yeah.
What do you know about pre-prohibition winemaking in California? Because you hear about California wines late 19th century, before World War I, before Prohibition, before the Great Earthquake in San Francisco, before that first recession, before the Depression, before some other vineyard plague that happened, I can't remember, a great oidium outbreak. There's just like a bunch of bad shit that happened in California, you know, in the first 40 years of the 20th century. So like late 19th century, these wines were actually somewhat prized in Europe. Was there good winemaking as we think of it today, where people understood their plots and tried to showcase terroir and made elegant wines? Have you ever had an opportunity to taste a 19th century California wine? I've never even seen one around.
No, I have not had the pleasure to taste something from the 19th century. I am not a historian in so much, and I can tell you all the answers to your questions about what the wines were like and what they were being made. It was a very small community in, you know, mm-hmm. pre-prohibition of making a wine. They'll tell you that there was hundreds of wineries pre-prohibition, and then post-prohibition it was only about 30. And yes, that's true, but they were all immigrant run. So, you know, Larkmead was founded and was built in 1884. We got most of our history comes from, you know, the California State Fairs and the record books of what wine we made and what medals they won, you know, gold, silver, and bronze. With these immigrants, they used a lot of the regionality names that we see in Europe about, you know, things like Burgundy and Hock and Moselle, and so then, you know, Sauternes. Like, these were the names of the wines because they were made, because those are the wines of the world that informed them. California didn't have a history, didn't have a recognition of quality or respect, so they just, you know, used what informed them. The winemaking practices back then were, you know, look, UC Davis, as the number one viticultural school in the world, still made wine in 5-gallon buckets up until the recent era in the last 5 to 10 years when they built their on-campus winery. 5-gallon buckets. So, you know, winemaking, wine, the beauty of wine is, I think, that we, and the reason why I think the natural wine movement is so important, is that wine is resilient. Wine grapes will make wine. I mean, it is resilient. It could withstand a lot of the process, of the actual fermentary process, the heat process. And I do think that we can all make really good wines with very substandard resources. And, you know, we're pretty sophisticated today. And it's not just us. I always joke around people think that we manipulate and we do things in California. I said, I always tell everyone who knocks California or Napa Sonoma wines, look at the names and all the equipment. They're all made by the French, German, and Italians. We didn't make any of them. Like, we don't know how to make that equipment. That, you know, whether it be sorters or optical sorters or reverse osmosis machines or, you know, filtration machines. Like, Americans don't make any of that. All that was created by the people that inspire us.
Right. And if you are a not conscientious producer in California, and you're someone who doesn't care as much about, you know, the natural wine movement in the vineyard, the amount of input that you have to add to the vineyard is still not that high compared to other places in the world, but that might be wetter, more humid. There's also that aspect of it.
Oh, California is a perfect place to be organic, to be natural. It's dry. It's dry during the entire peak of the growing season. There's so much opportunity for us to as a region to kind of own that as a philosophy and a future. And I wish we had more commitment to it, and it has to come from the higher levels. It has to come from, you know, from the bigger bulk brands that dominate the consumption of wine in America. And I'll be honest about that. But you see, on the smaller, more boutique levels, like the Larkmead levels, and some of the, you know, the names that are etched in the pantheon of a great California Cabernet, Napa Valley Cabernet. These are all, you know, organic farmers, and some even going to biodynamic.
Yeah, but it's not part. It's not. You don't sell it as an organic or biodynamic wine. You sell it as great wine. And that's the secondary. He also said something that I found surprising, the importance of the natural wine movement as it relates to the resilience of the vine. Like the fact that vines are resilient is like the first thing that you learn when you start learning about wine, that, you know, vines can grow in a place with no topsoil. They can grow in a lot of different extremes. There's a pretty large swath between the coolest places and the warmest places that vines can grow. And that made me think that, wow, vines can grow even if you're adding some pretty strong, you know, pesticides or herbicides. But then on the flip side, even if you don't do those things, you can still grow, you know, you can still grow vines. And there's some disease vines that make really lovely, really lovely wines. So that resilience of wine of the vine grape can go on both sides. And I found that to be something that was interesting.
No, they're growing up in Brooklyn and looking at the trees in the backyard. And I remember when I was about 12 or 13 years old, someone said, that's not a tree, that's a weed. And it grew as high and as tall as the trees around it. And because they'd been living there for in that house for as long as they could remember. And you know, I think plant life, and you know, and I'm not an expert in any of it, there is a resilience to it, to this world. And unfortunately, like, look, I mean, consider what we put in our bodies. You know, drinking a very high syrupy, sweet and bitter Campari might be the equivalent of using Roundup in essence, in reality, right? So that's something that we have to, you know, consider. We are resilient beings, and I think the planet around us is resilient. But you know, I worry that we're pushing it a little too far.
I agree. I just want to finish up about this segment. We're going to take a quick break and talk about Masakan. But the challenges of the future of Cabernet and the potential of the future of Cabernet. I know these are massive topics. I'm sure you're going to dive into them tomorrow, but none of us will be there.
I'm sorry.
Maybe a few of our listeners. But what do you find to be the biggest challenges? Are they the economic, environmental, the taste of the consumers? Is there something that I'm not thinking about to one of those three? And then where do you think is the biggest potential?
You hit the nail on the head. I think part of this whole concept is understanding what the future demand is going to be, and understanding where the markets are moving. But part of it is also that I do believe that Cabernet has the most resilience of all grape varieties, and it can overcome climate change. It can overcome a lot of the poor natural resources of soil, as you described earlier, Joe, of where a vine can grow. I do think that Cabernet that's why it is the king, in my eyes. But we can't always put a regal cape on it. You know, we can't always have a very big, heavy, lush, luxurious coating on it. And I'm not talking about style here. I'm talking about price as well. I mean, we have to be able to allow Cabernet to reach a wider audience at a price point that is high quality, that is grown effectively in organic environments or even non-organic sustainable environments, and make it a more democratized king of all grapes in my eyes.
I agree. All right. On that note, we're going to take a really quick break. We'll be back more with Dan Petrosky of Larkmead and Masakan right after this.
Take a sip from your chalice, just and I bow my head.
Think about what it takes to swim a coastline longer than the entire eastern seaboard and leap tall waterfalls in a single bound. What does it take to survive 200 feet deep in icy salt water? What would you be made of? Tight muscle mass, long chain omega-3s, and incredible micronutrients. It matters where your food comes from. Experience the flavor of the fittest in every bite and enjoy food the way Mother Nature intended. Alaska seafood. Wild, natural, and sustainable. Ask for Alaska on the menu, grocery store, or smart device. For more information, visit www.wildalaskaseafood.com. Prove my devotion. I know it will get easier over time. Tick off the days by swimming up the rise. Ba 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 da da ba da ba ba da da ba ba da ba.
All right, we are back. I neglected in the first segment to congratulate you on being the San Francisco Chronicle Winemaker of the Year. Brooklyn boy made good. Congratulations.
Thank you, Joe.
Very happy for you. Very excited. I really want to, in the second segment, focus on Masakan. This is the wine that that introduced me to your work. As I said, it was part of our opening list, and you can find it at Fausto right now. You are making fresh, crisp, beautiful, lively wines using some grapes that are Italian in origin in California. Tell us about how Masakan came to be.
Sure. It wasn't really meant to be a winery. in actuality. I have a history in corporate world here in New York City for 10 years, working in Time Inc., working for Sports Illustrated and Time. And over the course of that period, I worked in publishing. So I had a bit of a, worked on the editorial side, had a bit of a creative side to me. Then I also worked in the financial and the consumer marketing and sales aspect of it. During that period, I went to business school and met some wonderful people and who today, my business partner in Masakon. So when I was working at Larkmead for, you know, going on 3-4 years, I was a small team, so I was exposed to a lot of aspects of the business, and I needed to run the exercise myself through a business plan to see if the wine industry made sense. And so that was just truly the way Masakon started. It was like, all right, if I have this business plan to see if it makes sense, and I'll be honest with you, it doesn't make sense. The wine industry is a tough one.
There's the old adage that the best way to make a small fortune in the wine industry is to start with a really large one.
Exactly. but it was funny. So I needed a second opinion, and I sent my plan to my friend and who is now my business partner, my longtime friend from business school, who helped set me up on my career path in wine by making the introductions in Sicily, where I worked for a year. And he looked at it and said, "Let's make wine." And I was just kind of like, okay. And you know, being an assistant winemaker at the time and getting the support of my boss and mentor at the time and the owner of Larkmead to kind of explore and see the world and hopefully to inform me to be a better winemaker at home at Larkmead. It was just the generosity of it was incredible. And even though the math didn't really pencil out.
Right. Well, how did you know? So you knew you wanted to do something that wasn't Cabernet. You don't want to compete with your bread and butter there, right? And you had this Sicilian experience. You told me when you came into Fausto. I didn't realize this that you know the Benanti family quite well, and I know that you were working at Valle della Catte, they make some like really beautiful Frappato. Mm-hmm. Everyone thinks of Occhi Pinti, and as do I, is the queen, but Valle della Catte makes some very pretty wines as well. But how did you even come across these Italian grapes in California? Yeah. Who knew?
No, it was insane. You know, the first thing that completely informed me about Masakon was, you know, when I lived in Italy, the climate was very Mediterranean, very hot, very dry, and we were surrounded by a lot of inputs of great, beautiful blossoms and salinity of the sea and just floral notes and freshness notes and citrus notes, and those are the things that really informed our eating and drinking habits, being in that part of the world. And I noticed when I was in California that we weren't really informed with our eating and drinking based on our externality of weather. And it was odd to me. And I think that's a cultural bridge that we have to cross as American consumers, that we're not there yet. It takes generations and time to do that. So I was at a loss. I literally, every time I went home and I came back from SFO, I would stop at a small Italian wine shop called Beyond Vino in San Francisco, buy a case of wine, bring it to Napa. It was always fresh, interesting wines. It was the wines of the Benantes. It was the wines of Valle della Catte. And I would bring them up to Napa Valley and taste them and enjoy them because the climate was perfect. So that was really what informed Masakon. How I ended up with working with things like Tokaj Filano, Ribolla Giallo, Greco, etc., was that every year we have to produce a report on how much tonnage of grapes that we harvest and make wine out of. And in February, everyone anxiously awaits for this in California. It's an agricultural report. And you just start to see all the diversity of what's in the state, and you just get amazed by it. And like where the F is this? Like, where is this planted? Then you do a Google search, and then you find out that, you know, that there's Ribolla Giallo in Oak Knoll, and it's made by, you know, this planted by this gentleman named George Vare, and C. Mathiasen is helping him. And George was selling it to Food and Wine when Bobby Stuckey was, the French Laundry when Bobby Stuckey was there. And this whole ball unravels, and you're like, wow. And then you call up C. Mathiasen, and he's like, yeah, George is going to sell some of his fruit this year. And then you call up, you know, you tell your friends that you're looking for awkward, weird, Italian grape varieties. And, you know, you get a guy like Tegan Passalacqua who, like, immediately responds and is like, hey, you got to talk to the Nicolini family out in Chiles Valley. And so it's just a community of people who have their boots on the ground and who are out there helping each other. And if you have a crazy, wacky idea, you better not keep it to yourself in California, because if you do have a crazy, wacky idea, you talk to anyone and everyone's going to support you with generosity and resources.
Very cool.
Yeah.
I remember in 2006, 2007, my roommate at the time, Alex Zink, who has a great Michelin star restaurant in DC called The Dabney. We were living together. He brought home a 500 milliliter bottle of dry orange wine called Vare, made of Ribolla. And when I met Abe Schoner about a year or two later, I said, I'm so happy to meet you. I love your Vare wine. I knew it was inspired by Italy. I had no idea who George Vare was. And so you'd met him.
Yeah.
How did that meeting go? What a visionary.
He's a larger than life man. And, John Konsgaard was his winemaker at Luna, and Abe followed suit after that. And so, George took everyone to the Northeast Italy to find a great Pinot Grigio of the world. And so he met, because Luna was a Sangiovese and Pinot Grigio house. And so he had a vineyard in his backyard that was Pinot Grigio based, and he fell in love with Ribolla of all weird things. And he had that relationship with Serena Palazzolo as Ronco de Niemitz. And so he was just every year going out to the source, just like all the great winemakers of the world always are being inspired by visiting other regions.
But his source was Friuli.
Ended up being Friuli.
And before Bobby Stuckey.
Yeah.
I wonder if he went with Bobby Stuckey. I would love to know that lineage before Bobby opened up his great, I think, national, one of the best restaurants in the nation, Frasca.
Yeah. Well, Bobby and Lachlan, that was 2004 when they started Frasca. So, George brought over Budwood in 2000, 2000. So Bobby was at French Laundry at the time and Lachlan was at French Laundry at the time. So there was that mutual connection there. And George made the first kind of Ribolla blend in California at Luna called Freakout. And he got some actually Tocca Friulano from Larkmead, some old vines that are on the property. We don't have a specific date, but we know they were definitely pre-1950, maybe even back into the 1890s. And George got some budwood from there. And I remember, kicking dirt with him and Steve Mathias and saying, all that, a lot of it was diseased. And yeah, of course it is. A lot of the old budwood that we're going to get from old vines in Napa Valley are going to have a 1,001 diseases, just like the Gromner budwood that George brought back from Friuli, Slovenia border that was diseased. And yeah, it was amazing. Quite a small niche speckle of dust in a bigger sea of wine, but really just a wonderful period.
And how many producers of Ribolla are there now?
California. In 2009, when George opened up the gates to the vineyard, I believe there were 7 to 9 of us, and he brought us all together after the harvest to taste all of our wines together, and that's a tradition that Steve and Jill Mathiasen have kept going since George's passed. And so every year in July we have a Ribolla Fest, and it's funny, all my friends in Friuli will think that we care more about Ribolla than they do.
I love it. I know everyone takes a different approach to Ribolla, but is there something that is in common with everyone who's attracted to the grape?
I think the versatility.
What brings you two together? All of you guys together.
I think the versatility, and I think we're all inspired by the singular vision of one person. We all follow a tribe, right? And George led that tribe, Ribolla as a grape variety has three identifications. It trying to be a fresh white wine, and it's very difficult to do in a very cold, rainy region like Friuli. The Slovenians believe that macerated on the skins is a true nobility of that grape. The Friulians will argue that's not true. Because they weren't able to ripen properly, and having all that kind of that youthful underripe acidity. They started making sparkling wine out of it. So you can see Rebolla as a sparkling form. You can see it in its macerated form as an orange wine. And you can see it as, you rarely see it as a fresh wine, the way I treat it.
Right. It's very interesting. And now I know that you've been making a little bit of wine in Friuli as well.
Yeah.
Gaspari.
Yes.
How did that come about?
That was an amazing experience. I've been, since 2010, I've been visiting the region to kind of understand a little bit more about the grapes that I'm working with, and just to kind of, you know, be a part of an international community. My love is more towards Italian wine, so I spend most of my time traveling through Italy, and over the course of time, getting to know Serena Palazzolo and Christian Pitat at Niemetz, we just, you know, 2-3 years into the relationship, we're having dinner at Thanksgiving, American Thanksgiving at La Subida, and we're talking about all the great, you know, just drinking great wines. I remember exactly the wine we were drinking. It was a 2004 Sauvignon by Vidi Romans, and they were like, we should make wine together. And it blew my mind. I was like, what? Like, it was definitely, look, I'm saying this publicly for the first time. It was definitely something I wanted to do. I definitely wanted to, you know, kind of to make some wine in Europe and especially Italy.
Were you dropping not so subtle hints?
No. I'm much more of a person that I need you to understand and respect and respect me over time. I'm not going to try to take advantage of a situation or be that dumb, you know, kind of, you know, bull in the china shop American who's like, I want to come in and make some wine. That's not who I am. Not saying that there are people like that in this world. I'm just saying, like, I want them to trust me. And I want them to understand that it means a lot to me what they have offered me, and that's it's an important part of relationship building in the wine industry, and is gaining each other's trust. As a salesman, Joe, you know that you need to gain your diner's trust.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. Well, the wine is beautiful.
Thank you.
I really love it. Congratulations on that. I have one last question for you. I know that in the long history of Larkmead, there had been many different grapes that have been planted there, including some obscure Italian grapes. If there was any grape that had been planted at Larkmead in its past that you could resurrect, what would it be?
That is a really tough question because I am a staunch, it's a whole other podcast, I'm a staunch believer that red Italian grapes in America do not do well.
Wow.
I just pissed off a few people. But
white grapes in America do well. All of America.
We have that's another podcast about how grape varieties are transportable.
Tune in next week.
No, okay. but Larkmead's had 28 different varieties over the course of its 120 plus year history. And we only know that through the records keeping there. Up until 1995, when the Bakers replanted the property, it was there was a Chardonnay, Chanin Blanc, and Sauvignon Vert, i.e. Tokaj Fajlano. And that was 60. It was almost 60% of the total property. In 1939, Dr. Harold Omo planted 14 Italian varieties, including variations of Sangiovese, variations of Nebbiolo, Pellaverga, Gringolino, everything, Barbera. Putting my business hat on, Napa is Cabernet country, and it deserves to be. It's not. I want to make great Cabernet first before we make something else.
All right. Yeah. So I'd encourage all of you guys to go drink some Napa Valley Cabernet, specifically Larkmead. Forget about this reverse snobbery and drink some really good Napa Cabernet. I do it, and I'd encourage you to as well. And for sure, the Mossican wines are just so beautiful. Hopefully, the weather will get warmer, and you can have some really fresh, crisp, lively, mineral, delicious Mossican wine on your table as well. Dan Petrosky, what a pleasure. Brooklyn native, guest on In the Drink.
Awesome.
Great to have you here. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Joe. My pleasure.
I want to thank everyone at Heritage Radio Network. I miss you guys so much. Dave Tadashore, putting the show together. You're the man. I really appreciate it. And thanks to all of you for listening. Come visit me at Fausto or listen to another episode of In the Drink. Bye.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.